Greetings, friends. This is Jay Michaels at the Passion Pit, speaking with the movers, the shakers, and the indie art makers of New York City and beyond. May is going to be a wild ride. Two Miller plays, plays at the legendary La Mama and the ATA, two world premieres, and an open-end run and plenty of hijinks that are improv'd. I'll never stop talking this month.
Oh, now that's a thought.
Okay, today's guest is a powerhouse producer heading an ambitious and cutting-edge company, breathing new life into one of the definitive works of one of the 20th century's most renowned playwrights. Let's chat with Allison Wick of Hunger Theater about the revival of Arthur Miller's The Crucible.
Hello.
Allison Wick.
Yes, hi.
This is Jay Michaels. If I'm on the line, you're on the air.
Hi, Jay. How's it going?
Very well. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
You should be lauded from every rooftop. I am so thrilled. I am thrilled whenever I hear young artists tackling the great classics and finding new and interesting things to do to them. And Hunger Theater is no exception. You guys are on the top of the list. You're grabbing Arthur Miller. How wonderful. Tell us about The Crucible. Why The Crucible? Why now? Why did Hunger do it? The whole works. Tell us all about it.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, you know, I have a history with the play. At the very mature age of 13, I played Elizabeth Proctor in my Shrewsbury High School production of The Crucible.
That's great.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, and that was, I think that was my first experience with the play, and it really left an impression on me, and I just have loved it ever since. But obviously, I think there were probably some things that went over all of our heads at the time, or that we weren't able to really dig into completely as, you know, a freshman in high school me.
Indeed.
So it's definitely something that I have wanted to revisit for a long time. You know, I mean, our theater company really was born out of wanting to do great plays and wanting to do things that we felt passionate about without having to wait around to get cast in them. So
that's the whole essence of independent theater, isn't it? It's the artist taking control of their career. Wonderful.
Absolutely.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, thinking about plays that I wanted to do and roles that I wanted to play, I won't be playing Elizabeth this time around. I'll be tackling Abigail. But yeah, this was just a play that was very near and dear to my heart, and obviously that continues to have relevance.
Tell us about the relevance of it. Obviously, Arthur Miller had a master plan. He took the witch hunts and he put them right in the middle of the McCarthy era. So we now see this and we wince and we go, okay, thank you, Arthur, we get it. Why now? What's the crucible to us now at this stage in the 21st century?
Absolutely, yeah, that's a great question. Well, you know, as soon as we decided to produce this play, when we started telling people about our plans, people would say to us almost invariably that they thought that this was such an important play to be doing right now, and that, you know, it is, it does have importance today. And, you know, I think that if you're looking for direct connections to the McCarthy period, one of the clearest ones that I think is, take a look at who Joseph McCarthy's right-hand man was.
Oh, my gosh.
That was, yeah, a man named Roy Cohn,
who
also happened to be a very dear friend and mentor of Donald Trump. So if you're looking for, you know, a direct line from A to B, I think that's a great one.
Oh, for sure.
And, you know, I do think, apart from that, this play really has a larger relevance. And I guess the only thing that I would say is that I was wary in producing this play of making it just about our current administration, because I don't think Arthur Miller was writing about just a single person or a single party. or, you know, a politician or a set of politicians. The roots of these questions really are much deeper, and they go far beyond just the question of the particular administration at that time or at this time, or, you know, who was in power in Salem in the 1600s.
Right.
And, you know, I think the play speaks very powerfully to the fact that these about some fundamental things in our society that not only the McCarthy period, but also the Salem witch trials as well, were about questions of property, questions of, you know, land disputes, class, gender, race. And these are all things that are deeply embedded in the structure of our society. And so I think it was important to me that this be about much more than any one administration, that, you know, the things that tie when this play was written to today, and also the Salem witch trials to the 1950s, for that matter, it's really about something much larger and something much deeper. So while, of course, I definitely see and feel the particular relevance that the play has at this moment, I mean, you know, it's impossible to be directing a play, directing a scene in which someone is being dragged from their house, arrested, and, you know, thrown in jail, where they're basically just left to rot. It's impossible not to think about the current situation with immigration right now, and, you know,
sure,
children being locked up in camps. But at the same time, I think there are, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I also think about things like the Patriot Act, which was a bipartisan thing. And, you know, I mean, there were Democrats that participated in the McCarthy trials as well. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of relevance. And I think it's something that what I love about the play is that it really does a great job of examining some of the various ways in which these things have historical roots and the structural roots in our society. And you really have to look at those things if you want to get more than just a superficial understanding of it.
Do you think we're seeing I look at it almost like a cautionary tale, because the Salem witch trials again showed us how one group of people deciding what is right and then destroying others, and then we see the same thing in the 50s. Do you think we're seeing that same sort of cautionary tale now? You know, with fake news and enemies of the state, and while people are starving, we're hearing tweets about how Saturday Night Live is doing terrible things. Do you think we're I know nowadays a lot of people, and you just brought it up brilliantly with Roy Cohn, nowadays people are now saying this all began with Reagan, and so we're seeing the byproduct going all the way back there. Do you think a play like this, when viewed properly and when presented properly, we're saying, oh, wait a minute, guess where this is going to lead? Do you think you're handing your audience a be careful sort of story?
I don't know if it's a be careful sort of story. I think for me, you know, it's not just about, oh, this is where things could go. Although, yeah, I mean, sure, I guess that's always a possibility. For me, it's more about in what ways are the things that were present during McCarthyism not just reappearing, but in what ways have they really stayed the same all along?
Oh,
yeah, for me, that's really what it is. And I would say, you know, in my opinion, it's not simply about, you know, one group of people deciding what's right. It's about who has the power in society. And again, I've said this a little bit already, but when I say that, I don't only mean, you know, a particular politician. It's also about, you know, the class that's in power. And
mm-hmm.
the interests of kind of the state in general, and that's the same state under McCarthyism as under Obama, Bush, and now Trump. You know, it's interesting. I think about there was so Boots Riley's film Sorry to Bother You made a big splash in the past year, and people, I think I saw, he said this in a few different ways in interviews, but I think I saw it also on Twitter that, you know, someone was saying, this is really one of the, this is the first great work of art to come out of the Trump era. And he responded to that and he said, well, actually, I wrote this under the Obama presidency. And the common thread is that it's the same system. It's not just about who the particular individual who's at the head. It's about the system as a whole. So yeah, for me, I guess that's where the heart of it lies, in my opinion.
That's very fascinating. I'm hearing that a lot. I heard it from Michael Moore. I heard it from many people that were all lauding Obama, saying, oh, we miss him. There were things going on that we had no idea. We were just blinded by the fact that he looked like he was doing a good job, that there were things going on there. So I guess your point about how it kind of all stays the same. It just depends on what color glasses we're looking at them through is a really powerful one.
Right. I mean, until you change the system as a whole. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, good luck on that. A lot of independent theaters, they talk about, you know, their mission of bringing powerful works, of bringing honest works and everything like that. You say the same thing, but you say it in a very different way. You use words like scrappy. And you use verb words. Everyone talks about, you know, the feeling within and the mission to improve and the truth. But you're coming right down to it saying, I'm going to knock down a door. Tell us about Hunger Theater. Even the name there, Hunger Theater, you know, it's not, you know, the international theater of thought provoking moments.
Right.
No, it's
right,
you're basically saying, you know, gimme. Tell us about Hunger Theater.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think what you've just said about it it's a great observation. I mean, we do, like I said, this comes from, our whole company comes from a deep hunger or desire to actually be doing the work. And, you know, we're a young company. We don't have a whole lot of means. And so our goal really is we want to tell stories that we feel passionate about in the most direct way that we can. I think sometimes there can be a tendency to have to talk about for theater companies to talk about the, you know, human empathy and all these kind of nice sounding things, but we really want to, regardless of, you know, the kind of sets we can afford or the kind of spaces we can afford to be in, we want to be producing excellent acting work and really getting to the core of whatever piece it is we're approaching. I mean, you know, at this point we don't have a particular genre that we are married to. We like to explore different kinds of things. Just last year we did a very contemporary piece called Everything Will Be Different by Mark Schultz. So, you know, we like to dip our toes into a lot of different genres, but really the fundamental drive behind what we're doing is to produce stories that we feel, that make us feel, and I think that hopefully will make other people feel things, whether, you know, like the play we did last year, I think in a lot of ways was very uncomfortable for our audience, but it really packed a punch. And that's something that we really strive to do, is to create there's a kind of, I think, theatrical magic that maybe most theater artists are going after, but that can come from just simplicity. And you don't need fancy sets. You don't need fancy costumes. You just need to know what the story is about and what the heart of it is. And if you focus on how to communicate the heart of that story with the audience, that's really, in my opinion, that's what theater is all about. So
I am so glad you said that. Yeah. I'm so glad. Here's my confession. I was brought up on the glitz and glamour. I was brought up both working in and seeing Broadway and and spectacle. Everything I worked on in my youth was just, you know, covered in schmutz, just covered in this light. And now working with so many independent artists, I'm realizing that the work that I'm now seeing is that much better There used to be the old expression, they came out humming the costumes. And so, but what I'm seeing now, I'm seeing that, that less, not only is more, but less is more powerful. A show with two folding chairs and street clothes gets a point across sometimes so much stronger. Do you find as an artist that just working on the honesty, the acting, the power within the presentation and not thinking about, okay, in some cases, well, we don't have the money, so we're not going to think about it. But the fact that you don't have to think about the lights, the costumes, the set, blah, blah, blah. Does it make the work more stronger, powerful to you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and I think that there, that the glitz and the glamour, that all has its place too. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. But I absolutely, I really feel that. And to talk a little bit about The Crucible again, you know, Arthur Miller himself said that, when the play debuted on Broadway, it was directed by Jed Harris, who was this very famous Broadway director. And, Miller said that, that Harris had the idea that the play ought to be staged like a Dutch painting, which means that all of the actors were, would face forward. And it was kind of a that Harris saw it instantly as a classic and directed it as such for Broadway. However, you know, partly because of the political content, which I think a lot of people were very uncomfortable with at the time, obviously. But partly because of that, staging and that feeling of the production, the play didn't really fully find its place then. That it wasn't until years later, in fact, I think it was actually after McCarthy had died, he references, he said that basically a group of young actors set up chairs in the ballroom of a hotel and put the play on there. And it was that production that the critics finally responded to this play, and that it kind of took off from there. So it's very much in that spirit that, well, that we approach, I think, really all of the work that we do, but also with this show in particular, that, yeah, there, I think there is something about when you just sit with what the story is actually about and what the emotion is, the undercurrents there. You don't, although it may be nice to have, you know, really beautiful costumes and a really gorgeous set, it's not necessary.
Right.
And yeah, I think sometimes stripping that away can have the effect of making it clear what really is most important about these pieces.
Excellent.
So yeah.
Now you're doing, you're certifiably insane because you are also directing this.
That's right.
I did in 2004, I directed a play that I was also in, and I think I'm in therapy to this day because of it. What's, I'm coupling this with the fact in reading the reviews of your last work, you guys got sterling reviews. Audience and reviewers alike absolutely adored your work. So now I ask, what's the technique? What's the stamina? What's the battle plan behind being the director and being a major onstage portion of this really powerful work? What do you got to do for that?
Excellent question. Yeah. Well, you know, if there's one thing that I have learned about myself throughout my life and also throughout my my tenure as one of the founders of this theater company is that I am a control freak. And I really like, I just like things to be how I like them to be. And you know, the last play that we did, essentially I was on stage for, almost the entire show. There were maybe like a total of 90 seconds where I was off stage for really quick transitions, but that show, it probably would not have been possible for me to direct and play that role. I think, you know, I would have had to be certifiably insane to do that. But coming out of that experience, I really was hungry to direct. And yeah, I mean, it's definitely been a challenge. I'm fortunate to have a very talented understudy, Kelly, who has been a big part of the rehearsal process as well. She kind of allows me to see some things from the outside and kind of step in for me.
Very clever move.
Directing.
Very clever move,
yeah,
right there.
Yeah.
Good.
It's been so helpful. It really has. But yeah, you know, I mean, it's just, not very often as actors that we get to have that kind of creative agency and really, I mean, you know, you can control your own performance, but you also have to defer to some things that the director wants. And the theater company was born out of wanting to do things our way and really have the reins, take the reins. And I am really enjoying, as difficult and taxing as it is, and it is taxing. I can only imagine it will get more so, but I really love it. You know, we have a wonderful cast. It's just been a joy to work with them. And I'm really, it's so thrilling to me to work with these amazing actors and to kind of weave them into the vision that I have for this play. So to answer your question, yeah, I mean, I love it. I hope I can do more of it, although, you know, it is certainly a challenge.
It's so funny when you said control freak, I burst out laughing and I'm going to still laugh. Again, there's the honesty that I'm talking about with you guys. There's the directness. Someone else might be, well, it's really interesting and it's thought provoking. You gave me no buzzwords. You simply said, I'm a control freak. I want everything this way. And that's how it goes. Hence, there's the scrappy in your company. Now you're one of the founders. Who else, what are the great brains behind the operation, are there involved?
Yeah. So, it's basically the company is, founded by myself and my partner, Luke. We both went to school together, at Circle in the Square Theater School. And since then we, have been studying with, just an absolutely phenomenal acting teacher, Ken Schatz, since we graduated. We have largely worked with people from Ken's class. The first things we produced were really, you know, we cast just from our artistic family, basically. And this time around, you know, it's a bigger cast. We thought it made sense to kind of open things up, and we have some fresh faces coming in for this production. But our very immediate family is from around that acting class, which I think serves us very well because we all have a very similar vocabulary, way of thinking about acting and talking about acting, and to some extent, a shared aesthetic. And Luke and I really share an aesthetic that I think serves us very well, and was one of the reasons, you know, we love working together and wanted to work together in this capacity.
I'm seeing that more and more. That's hearkening back to the days it's going way back to the days of the Greeks and the days of Shakespeare when you get right down to it, because there was repertory companies there that were your traveling actors. But Tyrone Guthrie and of that era, it was basically a family that continued to work together, and they would just bring people into the family as time has gone on. That's a really good point, that everyone's sharing the same aesthetic, they're sharing the same thought process. It probably can even streamline things. So what's next for Hunger? Okay, you're doing Crucible. It's going to get standing ovations. Yes. Lots of people in there. Wonderful reviews. Marvelous, marvelous, marvelous.
Yes.
What do you do the next morning? Okay, show's over. What's the next morning?
Oh, well, the next morning, I think we're going to sleep a lot. We do have some plans on the horizon. I don't think I can say specifically what they are yet, but we have our eyes on the Chekhov piece. We also have our sights set on a Camus play.
Really?
So we are, yes. Uh-huh. So we'll see. Timeline is to be determined on those two things, but those are hopefully coming up fairly soon. We're excited about those as well.
I'm giving you one last question. Here's the real thought-provoking one. I am hearing I'm hearing the word millennial over and over again. Now I'm a real old man. Yeah. I'm the tail end of the baby boomer. So I remember black and white TV. So there, I've said it. But I'm hearing people say millennials over and over again. They're talking about the millennial thought process, the millennial values and things. I gather yours is a young company, so I guess we could say that you are millennials. What is the millennial aesthetic in the art? What is the contribution that we will see from this new generation in art? Theater or even beyond? What are we seeing in the next generation?
That's a great question. I don't know that I can say, you know, I'm not sure if I speak for, you know, the millennials as a generation necessarily. I'm kind of interested artistically in actor-driven theater. You know, I'm obviously an actor first. And so as far as theater and independent theater goes, yeah, I mean, I think there is somewhat of a return to kind of minimalist theater and exploring classic pieces in some new ways, maybe. But at least my approach to that, and I think we see a lot of that now, but my approach to that is that that's all well and good, and it's very fun to kind of bring a new, fresh light to some classics. But I always think that good acting is much better than any sort of clever directorial concepts or any kind of, you know, oh, we're gonna set it all to pop music. So for me, I can't speak for the rest of the millennial generation, but I find that really just sticking close to the artist's, the actor and the artist's duty of storytelling, and keeping it simple, but staying true to that that lineage of storytellers in the theater.
You're saying, you know, let's dispense with all the parsley around the main meal. Let's find the meat. Let's find the heart of what we're talking about. You're getting right to the heart of things.
That's what I would say our company is about. Yeah, you know, I certainly wouldn't want to dismiss the other fun things that people are doing with classics. But as far as what I'm interested in and the direction that, you know, we take things, yeah, you know, I mean, I think we can sprinkle in a few some new things here and there, and our Crucible does that. I mean, we have actors, about a third of the company is playing multiple roles. So we're doing some things that are maybe a little fresh and dynamic and not your typical Crucible production, but all that in the service of the story. I never want to distract from the story. I never want to presume that, oh, I know more about this than Arthur Miller did when he wrote it, or I can do something with this play that Arthur Miller didn't do. You know, Arthur Miller didn't give us enough. I need to make this, you know, relevant today. That's something I very much want to avoid. I think it's all well and good to have fun with that kind of stuff. But at least in my focus, I hope to really remain true to the original intent of the author.
It's really well put. It's really ironic what you're saying. You're basically saying, you know, you don't have to try to make it relevant. It still is. Just read it, for heaven's sake. Just listen to what we're saying. Yeah. Don't wait for the helicopter to land. Just see what we're saying. There's another company who's doing another Miller play. They're doing the Archbishop's Ceiling, and they're doing it the same month as you. So it's like a Miller month. May is Miller time here. And their philosophy is the same thing. They take rare works and they simply do them again. They don't put glitz on them. They just say, see these works that didn't work once before? Listen to them again. And it really is amazing, because that seems to be, and I'm listening to it in what you're saying. That's the thing. It's like, okay, no, let's just find the heart of things. Stop putting on the rose-colored glasses. Let's see what's in front of us.
Right. Yeah. You can add fun things to it, but if you end up distracting from the actual content of the play, then what's the point?
Exactly.
It's a fine line that you're walking there.
Exactly. You're showing the real honesty. And it's rather ironic with the name of your company. You're not, you know, the Hunger Theater. You know, when you're hungry, you're not going to sit there and say, well, this is how I want my steak cooked. No, you're hungry. And so that scrappiness is coming through. The hunger is coming through. And I'm sure your production is going to be absolutely startling. I look forward to it immensely. And my biggest wish is that I have to stand, because every seat in the house is taken. Allison, thank you so much. This has been wonderful.
I can't wait to
get this out there and tell everyone to go see Arthur Miller in the 21st century the way it needs to be done. Thank you so much.
Fabulous. Thank you so much, Jay. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure, too. I'll talk to you soon. Ciao.
All right. Bye-bye.
Would you like more people to attend your show? At Applaud, we combine artificial intelligence and human intuition to expand your audience and increase ticket sales. For a limited time, we'll help you fill your seats free of charge to prove our value. That's right, we will promote your show at no cost if you begin right away. Sound good? For more information, email promote@applaud.com.
The Crucible opens this month of amazing works in the indie scene. As we go along, we'll hear updates from our friends at the Improvisational Repertory Theater Ensemble. We'll hear about The Floor is Lava at La Mama. We'll chat with Kenthito Robinson about his true story of the valiant African-American Buffalo Soldiers during World War I as he depicted in his play. We'll meet the Wednesday Repertory Company and their premiere of their full-length dramedy, Carcass. We'll talk to our old friend Jake Lippman and the premiere of her new play, Recent Tragic Events. We'll chat with Barnaby Edwards and the Regenerations Theater's presentation of another Arthur Miller play, The Archbishop's Ceiling. What? Never heard of that? It's never been done in New York until now. And we'll culminate with our old friend Anthony Piccioni and his celebrated play, A Therapy Session with Myself, now in Open and Run. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen.